like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And my guest today is Mara Vistenthal, a reporter for the New York Times who covers significant stories across Asia. Vistenthal wrote The Panda Factories, an extraordinary piece of investigative journalism that probes the impact of China's gambit almost 30 years ago to send pandas to zoos in other countries, hoping the visiting animals would breed, ultimately resulting in pandas that could be returned to the wild. As Vistenthal's expose makes clear, that plan didn't work, not even close. Even just the sub-headlines of the piece pack a wallop and telegraph the disturbing saga. I'm going to read a few of them now. Nearly three decades later, more pandas have been removed from the wild than have been released, and aggressive artificial breeding has injured and even killed pandas, and what the program does best is make more cubs for zoos. So against the backdrop of the celebratory zeal greeting the arrival last week of the two giant pandas at National Zoo in Washington, D.C., I'll talk with Vistenthal about her story, many of its revelations, and the way some reveal a textbook example of how zoos' so-called conservation efforts tend to be a little bit on the baloney side. At one point in the story, Vistenthal notes, no cubs born in American or European zoos or their offspring have ever been released. Later, more about her New York Times story and the challenges and pitfalls of the panda program covered therein when I speak with Mara Vistenthal in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Rick Chabity, executive director of the Suncoast Animal League in Palm Harbor, primarily discussing the Canines and Cowgirls Adoptable Pet Fashion Show happening this Sunday, October 27th at Neighborhood Bark from 4 to 8 p.m. But right now, let's discuss the complicated, troubling realm of China's panda program as detailed in this extended New York Times piece, The Panda Factories, written by our guest today, Mara Vistenthal. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Mara Vistenthal, the Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals. It was a sort of photo finish with the connecting by Zoom, but I'm glad we're here. We're all together, so looking forward to talking to you about your story.
Me too.
So what was the genesis of that story? Had you developed concerns over time that you finally just decided to explore, or how did this come about?
Well, this is a story I've been thinking about for years. I used to be a science reporter based in China, and like many reporters there, occasionally covered pandas. You know, I visited the Wolong Breeding Center in Western China in, I think, around 2007, and, you know, was struck by the fact that tourists could pay money to take photos with the pandas. There was some kind of some commercial aspects of the way it was run that stuck with me, and then it was something at the time that a former employee told me that also stayed with me about how the animals were bred, and the fact that the females, she said, were subjected to just repeated inseminations over a span of days, and which meant that they were going in and out of consciousness, you know, in order to be artificially bred. And so that image stuck with me, and but I didn't think it would be possible to prove it or get people to talk to me on the record about it. And then, you know, years later, I'm in a role at the New York Times where I take, you know, we spend months delving into topics and really investigating them using every angle. And I realized that I could get records from the United States that would help unravel some of what happened in the panda breeding program. And so that's what we did. We got over 10,000 pages of documents and photos and videos, and we're able to tell a much fuller story than has ever been told before about the panda program.
So it sounds like a story that was kind of kicking around in your mind for some years from one angle or another. Was the catalyst really that then you had joined the New York Times and you felt like, now I've got the resources and probably the access to tell the story the way I really ideally would like to tell it?
No, I think, you know, I also realized that there was a detailed paper trail in the United States and that I could get some of those records using open records requests. You know, I also realized that the Smithsonian, which operates the National Zoo, has an archive that housed many records. So, you know, even like the journals of American scientists who worked on the breeding program in China, you know, very detailed accounts that they kept while they were breeding pandas. I got that level of detail, and you know, they videotaped many of the procedures as well, or photographed them, and so it was actually way beyond what I had hoped for.
Yeah, 10,000 pages of documents, that's quite a mountain of stuff to wade through.
Right, you know, and often when we have thousands of pages, you know, many of them are dry, but this is quite amazing material to, you know, to be able to read the journal entries of people who were working on this program and the photos that they were taking and you know, really their unvarnished thoughts.
Yeah, well, the story that results is a major and sprawling, in the best sense of the term, piece. So I'm going to sort of try to skip around a little bit, because one of the things that, well, it reveals all kinds of other important information. Your piece, The Panda Factories, displays a fundamental fiction about the, I touched on this a moment ago in the introduction, the conservation, so-called conservation efforts that many zoos tout, which is really, is kind of a fiction, because animals born in zoos are rarely, if ever, released into the wild. And this concept is sort of a core element of your story. Can you discuss how you first determined the supposed conservation outcome of the panda program didn't seem to hold up? And then, as you probably probed more deeply, it kind of widened out from there into something more nefarious and sort of mercenary?
Well, the conservation promise of the program is really sort of fundamental to the way it operates in the United States. You know, if we go back to the 1980s, China was sending pandas on short-term rentals to zoos in the U.S., where they would kind of perform tricks, like ride bicycles or lift weights, like lift barbells for crowds. And, you know, so those were obviously not conservation-focused loans or arrangements. And U.S. regulators intervened. There was a kind of consensus building by the late 80s that this was just not, you know, this was a bit of an embarrassment and did not have the animals' best welfare in mind. And there were also concerns that many of these animals had been removed from the wild, you know, which the concern was that the American zoos were sort of incentivizing the removal of pandas from their natural habitat. And so then they went about developing a more robust program where, you know, the American Zoo Association had input, the industry association for zoos and aquariums, the federal regulators had input, and the framework was that going forward, zoos could pay fees to Chinese groups in order to rent pairs of pandas. They could then breed the pandas, but the money would have to go to conservation, primarily in the wild. And so, you know, the promise was that the zoos would help revive this endangered species. They would at the same time give money for conservation in the wild. And, you know, that together China and the U.S. would save pandas. And they have succeeded.
It sounds wonderful if it would only hold up quite that, the way that description looks.
Yeah, that was the goal. I mean, they have succeeded at making more pandas. And the number of pandas in captivity has like more than quintupled to over 700 today. But those animals are almost all in zoos or breeding centers, right? So the central promise of protecting animals in their natural habitat and maybe eventually releasing them into the wild, that just hasn't materialized on the way that it was intended to.
Yeah. Well, that like you say, that's kind of pivotal to this story and your story overall. And it made me think about certain animals at zoos function as marquee attractions, and for many zoos, for many years, elephants served that role, attracting large numbers of zoo-goers. But for the last generation or so, the zoo industry has had something of a reckoning regarding displaying elephants, with the multiple zoos realizing that's no way for elephant to live, and sending their elephants off to various couple of the two major sanctuaries in the U.S. at least. And incidentally, a pioneer in this elephant evolution was Ron Kagan, the former director of the Detroit Zoo, whom you quote in your story. But for me, this phasing out of the elephant exhibits made me think about at least two sort of panda-related questions. To what extent do you foresee a time when there might be a similar reckoning with zoos reassessing the pros and cons of making deals to exhibit pandas?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up elephants. I mean, there has been a sort of trajectory of the public and zoos themselves questioning certain programs with these very charismatic and more social animals. So with zoos, sorry, with elephants, with tigers, orcas, polar bears, I think many people would probably agree that it's not appropriate to keep a polar bear in Florida or Texas at this point. I am not sure that at this point people are necessarily willing to think about pandas in the same way. I think people just love them as icons, as these cute, cuddly, animals that are unique in the world and that they can go see in zoos. I'm not sure that there will be a reckoning in the same way. It will be interesting to see, certainly. I mean, there are very enthusiastic panda fans in particularly in Asia, who follow pandas closely, who are quite interested in these welfare issues, and who have been advocating for better treatment of the animals. And so, I think certainly for them, the welfare issues are foremost. But for the average zoo-going public, it will be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help wondering if a deep, detailed investigative piece like yours might help spur just exactly, that kind of reassessing, if not the reckoning, but that might be a step towards that. Just because I think there's a lot of things that people, even if they're panda enthusiasts, would have no way of probably knowing before your piece was published and might find it disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that, you mentioned Ron Kagan. I talked to him for this article. I talked to many people inside the zoo world who work with pandas or around pandas. And it was not intended to be an indictment of zoos in general. There are, I talked to people who perform artificial insemination on endangered species and feel that there is a place for it, and that, it could be done, if done cautiously, it could be appropriate. I talked to others who felt that that was completely, that it's not needed in most situations. So there were a range of views represented in the article. I think the vision for the kind of new zoo is that it would have maybe a broader range of species, and that not be so centered on the big iconic species like pandas and elephants, but really allow people more to interact with what an you know, ecosystem looks like in the wild, which is an interesting concept.
Yeah. Well, I think that people are always sort of examining zoos and how they can transform themselves in one way or another. Hopefully, in many cases, with the animals' best interest in mind, just certain animals, as you pointed out, polar bears, as we touched on before, elephants and others, really aren't built for zoos, or zoos in certain climates, or zoos at all, depending on the animal. And it appears that very few U.S. zoos exhibit pandas. I mean, famously, the National Zoo in Washington, of course, D.C. does. I think the San Diego Zoo has some recently or currently. And others who've had pandas include, I guess, Zoo Atlanta and the Memphis Zoo. But it's not, it's interesting that it's not more widespread in some ways. I'm wondering if internationally it is more so.
Well, China has more pandas than ever before to lend out to foreign zoos, in part because of the success of this, in no small part because of the success of this breeding program.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there are more pandas in foreign zoos than ever before. And the United States is a major part of that. But there are also a trail of zoos that have examined, have thought about hosting pandas and passed for various reasons. One is the cost. The fees paid to the Chinese partners are quite high and even exceptional in the zoo world. But for some zoos, the economics do work out, and we looked at that in detail in our series. How for the National Zoo in particular, I mean, pandas are just an essential part of their identity at this point. They were the first panda zoo, the zoo that got pandas back in 1972 when Nixon made his historic trip to China. He traded you know, a pair of musk oxen for two pandas. And they've had them almost continually since then, have done a lot of branding and marketing around them. And, you know, we can see by looking at internal files that administrators were very keen on keeping pandas and particularly on making cubs. So the zoo would get, get just a huge boost in revenue and merchandise sales every time a cub was born. And so on top of having the last pair of pandas they had for over 20 years until last year, they also tried they tried continuously to make cubs. And you can see a sort of acceleration in, like, at first they tried to let the pandas naturally mate and it didn't work. The male attacked the female. And then over time they turned in artificial insemination and then began turning to kind of more cycles of artificial insemination. And at one point even discussed returning the female to China if she didn't produce another cub. So it's clear that cubs were sort of essential to the bottom line.
Yeah.
And what happens is you get a huge boost in visitors if you have a pair of pandas for the first year or two. Then that tapers off and, to boost revenue again, and merchandise sales and so forth, you need to attract, you need to make a cub to attract new visitors.
Yeah, well, there's a whole, you touched on a whole kind of substantial plot line of this saga with sort of, what I would just, being a little glib, say money talks, and there's a few different elements that I'd like to get to touch on, but it looks like we have a caller here that'd like to get involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Mara Fissendahl.
Well, I want to thank Duncan for having verified that it's the best animal-focused radio show in the known universe. And I also want to thank Duncan's guest, a real journalist, an increasingly unicorn item in today's media. And it takes a lot of courage to expose corruption, especially corruption in China and in the massive lobbying industry that captures animals. And I just have to give you a couple of quick things. I had a friend who worked at both Busch Gardens, which is in Tampa, an animal theme park, and in Clearwater at Clearwater Marine Aquarium, which markets itself as a rehab facility. But she got a PhD in animal studies and wildlife preservation, and I looked at a lot of her materials, and the humans have been taking wild beasts out of their natural habitat and destroying their lives for thousands and thousands of years. The Romans used them in colosseums. In England, the richest people in the 1700s used that would collect them and have menageries, all of which comes from human supremacy. The zoo industry, the so-called wildlife rehab industry, it's mostly greedy. It's mostly human supremacy. And I hope that you'll look into Busch Gardens. My friend who worked there said that the regulations protecting the animals there are extremely weak to begin with and are not enforced at all by state or federal officials. The same with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Dolphins and manatees routinely targeted by boats and jet skis. You can call it in and have the night license number of the motorized watercraft. Nobody will ever do anything. And I'll leave you in with the listeners, and everybody probably already knows this, but if some other species was to do to humans what we do to cows, pandas, wild animals, and domestic animals even, other than our pets, we would be outraged. So look at what we are, supposedly the only chosen free will ethical animal on the planet, and look what we do to all these other living creatures for money and ego. It's disgusting. Thank you for uncovering it.
All right, caller. Well, thank you. Mara, give you a chance to respond if you have any response to our caller. Otherwise,
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Busch Gardens, because they did actually try to get a pair of pandas back in the 1990s. They were very keen on getting pandas, and they were actively involved in the negotiations around the federal policy. There was also a Las Vegas casino that tried to get pandas at one point. And, you know, in the article, we looked at how currently there are pandas in an air-conditioned orb in Qatar. There are, you know, from the Chinese side, there's been a willingness to rent out pandas to any number of facilities. I think the reason some of those deals didn't go ahead in the United States is because of the particular way that the regulations are structured here.
Okay, because I, of course, was curious to see why Busch Gardens did not, if they were seeking a panda, why that didn't actually come through. But it sounds like maybe there was some bureaucratic options.
Yeah, they would have had to open their books to the federal government to some degree. They would have had to kind of fully account for revenue and so forth. The nonprofit zoos do that now. You know, they bring in outside auditors to confirm that they're not making a profit off pandas. You know, there is a fair amount of wiggle room in the auditing process, in terms of, you know, how you allocate profit and so forth. So, I mean, that's a whole other topic. But I think that's the reason that the Busch Gardens panda deal didn't go ahead, or one reason.
I got you. All right. For people who may have just tuned in a bit late, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Mara Vistendahl, an investigative reporter for the New York Times, who wrote The Panda Factories, an extraordinary piece probing China's plan to send pandas to zoos in other countries as part of a larger conservation, which I'm making furious air quotes around conservation, plan aiming to release pandas into the wild. And that's a plan that didn't actually work out, as Vistendahl's story makes abundantly clear. So you're invited to join this conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So kind of where we were before our caller, and really in some ways after, if not during, was sort of the financial elements of this whole panda program. Can you address the financial picture, starting with what a zoo, classically in this country, let's say the National Zoo, pays for the right to exhibit a pair of pandas for a finite period of time?
Sure. They pay up to $1.1 million US dollars a year per pair. And you know, as I mentioned, that money is supposed to go to conservation in China. They then, if they succeed in making a cub, they pay an additional fee up to around $600,000 for the cub. And, you know, but they can, the National Zoo at one point was making $2.4 million in panda merchandise sales, not just merchandise sales. You know, they, and pandas accounted for like 9 out of 10 of their most popular items. So, you know, for some zoos, the economics clearly do work out. Inside China, there is a fair amount of commercialization around pandas as well. The breeding centers that started out fairly small in the early 2000s. I mean, these are places in kind of in or close to panda habitat in Western China. You know, some of them with kind of the proper stores of bamboo and the proper climate and so forth. They have just exploded into major tourist attractions. The most touristy of them, the Chengdu Breeding Center, is you know, has, it kind of looks like I imagine Busch Gardens does today, like little shuttles to bring people from place to place because it's so large. You know, shops everywhere. There's a whole movie theater inside it, an IMAX theater. There, you know, it's just a huge attraction with I think 9 million visitors a year.
Wow.
And so there is this industry around pandas that's cropped up there. And that's something that Chinese conservationists have been critical of for years. You know, because of how sensitive this topic has become in China, we made every effort to speak with people, but ended up having to report a lot of it with these records in the United States.
And also, I think on a related note, as you talk about these sort of breeding centers that have popped up, back to some of the financial picture, sounded like from what you were saying in your article that some of these get bonuses for every cub that is born, and I guess has to live to 6 months to meet the criteria for the bonus. And then there was some other kind of bonus for what you called special achievements, which I have to ask about that just because I find that's weird and interesting at the same time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so China has made an effort to move away from the most aggressive artificial breeding. I mean, we're talking like 10 or 20 years ago, the females were routinely inseminated many times. You know, or we have, there's a scientific study that I looked at that actually American scientists wrote about, where they took a group of females, kind of improperly anesthetized them so that they were potentially partly awake, and then inseminated them up to six times in the short window in which they were fertile. And there were also, you know, there were pandas that, male pandas that were subjected to kind of incorrectly done sperm collection techniques and ended up with rectal bleeding and so forth. And those were the worst abuses. The centers have made an effort to move away from that, but the incentives are still set up to reward the production of animals quickly, right? So, you know, in the wild, female pandas would produce a cub around, you know, every 18 months to 4 years. The cub would stay with the mother for the first 18 months at least. And during that time, she would not go back into estrus or heat. And so what the centers commonly did was remove the cubs from the mothers shortly after birth or a few months after birth, and then place them in nurseries or, you know, sometimes place them together with other cubs so that they could then breed the female again. That was fairly common practice. That has decreased to some degree, we found, but the incentives are still there. And there is also more secrecy around how breeding is done in China now. So the cubs are off display, and you know that raises questions about how it is actually working, right? When the public is not able to know more about the process.
Right. Well, it's sort of the opposite of the kind of incredible work you did on this piece, which, you know, exposed a lot of things that I think a lot of people, even if they had concerns about pandas or just complete out-and-out panda lovers, like I said earlier in our conversation, I think would find this information that you were able to uncover quite disturbing. And again, I don't think you have to be super cynical to think that a lot of the story and the program and how it's fared and how it's succeeded or not succeeded is really money-driven in so many ways. And then, like you say, there's secretive. It sounds like if you're a zoo cutting a deal with about having a panda, that some of the conditions and things that you have to agree to have become tighter, more secretive, it sounds like. I mean, even at one point you talk about, I think, and maybe it's a sidebar, but how there's been a lot of these zoos, video feeds, video cameras, I guess, live cameras.
Right, the panda cams. Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's
true.
Sounds like that's been tightened up about what people can show and when.
Yeah, and the panda cams are interesting because they really exploded during the pandemic. People stuck at home,
sure,
Loved pandas, like used them to follow pandas. Even some of them kind of developed, you know, they would had their own favorite panda that they tracked. But they also became a way for people to check zoo conditions. And, you know, there are a few examples of abuses that were reported and corrected because of those panda cams. You know, the zoos would say, they may say that there are also situations where panda fans like read too much into what was happening on camera and contacted them about it. But in any case, they were a window into the kind of care that was being given. And under the current contracts, the zoos have agreed to run their footage on a delay. The National Zoo said they pushed back against that provision. That's what they told me, but they still said the footage is on some kind of delay. And, I think part of what's driving that is a controversy at the Memphis Zoo last year, where a panda died after fans had basically watched it deteriorate on camera. So that was an embarrassment for certainly the zoo, but also for the Chinese government and the Chinese partner in that deal. You know, it became a major issue for both sides to have to manage. And the zoos would not confirm that this is the case, but my reading of those contracts is that they are hoping to prevent a situation like that.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the delay is at least intended to make sure they could stop something from going out over the feed, you know, with how much window of delay there might be to intervene if they see something that would be of concern or disturbing to people watching the feed.
Right, but the zoos have also ceded transparency in their latest contracts. So even things like giving media interviews, for example, the new contracts say that they cannot give interviews about any sensitive topics without first getting approval from their Chinese partners. And it's not, the contracts name a few examples, but it's not entirely clear what all is considered sensitive. If I were a zoo director, I probably would err on the side of not revealing information to the public or the press.
Right, because if you were a zoo director, you might have something to hide along the way at some point or another. So again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Mara Wissendahl, an investigative reporter of the New York Times who wrote the newly published piece, The Panda Factories, which is now online. You're invited to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So any comments about if you read the story or if you have any comments about pandas or pandas and zoos, anything related, we'd be happy to hear from you. So, and actually one email did come in, Mara says, I was blown away by the story and the great reporting. I've always been suspicious about the pandas in U.S. zoos and the bogus, quote-unquote, conservation claims. Thanks for your great work.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, when a pair of pandas end up at a facility like the National Zoo or the San Diego Zoo, et cetera, the objective, obviously, or ostensibly at least during these residences, is to have a panda baby. But compounding the difficulties of, again, as we keep saying, quote unquote, or at least I keep saying, conservation, pandas are notoriously poor breeders. Can you address some of the challenges pandas face in captive breeding situations?
Right. You know, one of the things that was really fascinating to us is that pandas certainly have this bad rap for their breeding record. They're only fertile for a few days a year. The females are only fertile for a few days a year. And, you know, there's essentially like one chance a year that the zoos have to make a cub. But you know, what fascinated us is that the zoos have known for decades that some of these challenges are due to captivity itself, pandas in captivity commonly have stereotypies, these kind of specific behaviors that are exhibited by animals in like head tossing, cage climbing, sort of unnatural behaviors that they would not exhibit in the wild. And, you know, one study by a group of scientists at the San Diego Zoo found that nearly two-thirds of the pandas they studied in a seems like a variety of zoos had those behaviors. Then there, you know, if you also, like, if you have a pair of pandas in a zoo, they're not given mate choice, right? So if they're given a chance at natural mating, which is what the zoos say they prioritize, you know, it's really hard for them to replicate the way it happens in the wild, where you'd have multiple males kind of vying for one female panda. Some of the Chinese centers have actually started giving the female a choice because they now have so many pandas that they can do that. They have this sort of elaborate mating enclosure where they then kind of let the female check out different male options.
Okay.
So it's a little closer to the way it works in the wild.
Know.
But
yeah.
in an American zoo with two pandas, it's very hard to replicate that. So they end up turning to artificial insemination.
Yeah, that's I guess one of the many kind of upsetting portions of your story. I felt like that artificial insemination just seemed to be almost kind of routine, and moreover, the artificial insemination was sometimes carried out in a kind of sloppy fashion, and on occasion, as you've alluded to, the procedure was painful or actually, you know, injured the pandas along the way, which seems super upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, look, the American zoos are not these stories of six inseminations per cycle and so forth. That was like the early days of the program in China, maybe 20 years ago, up to 10 years ago. They are more commonly doing two inseminations and with more proper anesthesia. But we did look at situations where things have gone awry. You know, there was an attempted insemination at the National Zoo in 2011, where the female panda, Mei Xiang, was darted four times. So, you know, she was... You know, that means that she was kind of shot with a dart-containing anesthesia, but it didn't properly discharge. So then the zoo had to try to dart her again. But when you do that, you're not. The zoo isn't unsure if they're using the proper dosage, and the risks for the animal increase as well, as does the stress. So. She ended up stressed by that procedure, had vomited also after one round of insemination, and then was very slow to recover. So you know, all of this, the four dartings, two inseminations, the vomiting, slow recovery, and so forth, all of this was done, you know, in the name of making a cub. And in the end, they did not even produce that one that year.
Wow. Geez, that's a lot to go through for a result, no cub, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the point at which they said, you know, maybe we'll send her back to China if she doesn't make a cub. Yeah.
Well, thank God, eventually cooler heads did prevail here. We're sort of nearing the end of our time, Mara, but let me see if we can get at least one more caller in on the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Mara Vissendahl.
Oh, hello. I just want to thank you, Duncan, and the young lady you have with you. And
Mara.
Animals are innocent, and some humans are demons, I guess. And the orcas, you know, they're so intelligent. You know, I always thought a bird shouldn't be in a cage. So I'll just let y'all have it. Thank you. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the intelligence of orcas. I think one thing that's interesting about pandas is they're seen as so, like, charismatic and cute. They've historically been pretty easy to train, just how you had these pandas doing tricks in American zoos in the 80s. But they're actually quite shy animals. Like, in the wild, they prefer solitude. The ideal setup for a panda would just be to be far away from people and even other pandas. So it's interesting that we've turned them into this kind of icon that you know, is deserving of huge crowds.
That's a really good point, and that's one of those things that when you talk about animals that are in the spotlight for one reason or another, or the source of controversy, intelligence usually is figured prominently into whatever discussion there is. But it's interesting that there's other things that are mentioned about pandas, but not until you're mentioned just now, obviously, really their intelligence. And I think that's a super important point that gets glossed over.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mara. Well, I think we have just about reached the end of our time. And really great speaking to you. This has been Mara Vissendahl from the New York Times. Her big piece that we've been discussing is called The Panda Factories, and that's online now. So you can check that out if you're a New York Times subscriber. I think there's probably even, I think, a gifts link or a gifts get to read the piece. And Mara, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. Thank you for your huge, great piece and bringing all kinds of information to many of us who thought we knew about pandas but didn't know nearly enough until your piece ran. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
You bet. In a moment or two, I'll speak with Rick Chavity, who leads Suncoast Animal League. The focus of our chat will be the canines and cowgirls adoptable pet fashion show, live music, video booths, etc., all coming up this Sunday, October 27th at Neighborhood Bark. A portion of the ticket proceeds go to Suncoast Animal League. More on that in just a moment when we speak to Rick. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece about pandas, no less. This is Mike Birbiglia with a piece I've called Pandas and Porn, today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Everybody has watched porn at this point. Even the panda bears are watching porn. At the zoo here, at the National Zoo, you know that they're having a hard time getting the pandas to mate because the male pandas like eating more than they like mating, which I can understand. If I were a panda and I have sex with another panda, I wouldn't be that excited either. I'd be like, oh, great, she looks exactly like me. Can I get a bamboo sandwich or something? So what they're doing is they're showing the pandas porn to get them to mate. And I want to know, is it panda porn? Or is it human porn? Or is it humans dressed like panda porn? Which is some kinky panda porn that I might be interested in if it destroys lives. If it's human porn and I were a panda bear, I'd be like, yeah, I'll have sex with her. I'm sure I'm gonna have sex with her. And if it's panda porn, how could those pandas have sex with each other in the movie? Let's get that director on board. And that lead panda actor, the John Holmes of pandas, He's like, I do all the panda hoes, black, white, black and white. But I feel bad for these pandas, you know. Because they poop up to 135 times a day. That's got to be hard to have a serious conversation. You're like, honey, we need to talk. Oh, my God. Go behind a tree or something. I know we're bears, but come on. Oh, there goes me. Sorry about that.
That was Mike Birbiglia in today's Comedy Corner with a piece I'm calling Pandas and Porn, taken from his album Two Drink Mike. Now it's time to speak with Rick Shavity, head honcho of the Suncoast Animal League, about this forthcoming event they stand to get some proceeds from, the Canines and Cowboys Adoptable Pet Fashion Show. Here's Rick Shavity back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Rick.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. So let's start with some basics. Give us a brief overview, if you wouldn't mind, of the Suncoast Animal League. What is it? Where is it? And what is its mission?
Well, we're a 501c3 animal shelter. We're located at 1030 Pennsylvania Avenue in Palm Harbor, kind of downtown Palm Harbor. And basically, we're here for cats and dogs, and we do wildlife. With the cats and dogs that come in, you know, we get them, we take care of them, we provide them with whatever they need. Medically and such, and then we try to find the best homes possible for them. We do get wildlife. Like, for instance, during the hurricanes, we got a tremendous amount of baby squirrels that were blown out of the nest. So, and then we take those in. We actually have fosters for those, and then as they grow up and then get to their releasable stage, then we release them back into the wild.
All right. Well, sorry.
And we're December 2nd, it'll be our 18th anniversary.
Wow. Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. Yep.
So that's a pretty good overview. And since you touched on the hurricane, although you and I exchanged an email about this to arrange for today's conversation, but you guys, I guess, were lucky enough to fare pretty well through the hurricanes.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Duncan. We did very well. In fact, we were. Of course, we lost some power, but we had minimal damage, and that's very fortunate. Now, we had put all of our cats and dogs prior to the storm into foster homes, so that was a big help too. But because we had limited damage, as soon as the major part of the storms were over, we were able to actually. Help other shelters around the state that have reached out to us. And that's still going on. Probably 20 minutes ago, I received a call from another county shelter that is looking for us to take some dogs from them. So we'll probably be doing that in the next day or two.
That's, again, just an example of the kind of work you've done over these nearly 18 years, I guess. So
yeah.
Suncoast also organizes and or participates in a fair number of events. One of these coming up this Sunday, October 27th, is the Canines and Cowgirls Adoptable Pet Fashion Show. Seems like there's a lot going on. And tell me a little bit about this event.
Well, it's from 4 to 8. It's in downtown Safety Harbor. It's at the neighborhood Bark Bar, very dog-friendly. We've got a costume contest that'll be going on. And you mentioned the fashion show is a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
Not only are some cowgirls going to be dressed up, but we've got some of our adoptable dogs that'll be there, and they'll be dressed up too. There is live music, and there's a couple free photo booths and a 360 video booth, and it is really very, very, very cool.
For video selfies, et cetera, I guess, right?
Yeah. Just
capturing
exactly,
memories there. Yeah. And then a portion of the ticket proceeds from that event go to Suncoast, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. That's exactly right. And, it's a tough time out there because the storm damage and everything, and we've had for instance, our biggest event that we do all year long, Dogtoberfest, it's normally in November at Highlander Park in Dunedin. The city of Dunedin had to cancel that because that whole area that we use for the event is now being used by FEMA to collect the waste and such that are out on the streets and that stuff. So
yeah, disaster recovery. Yeah.
So we're losing that. That it's the biggest event we do all year long. So
that's being pushed into next year, 2025. Correct.
Yeah, well, we'll probably, there's a lot to the, when they take this waste, not only is it going to take a couple of months for them to be able to take it wherever they take it, but then after that, the grounds have to be tested to see if they're contaminated.
Right.
Which probably they will be, the grounds will be, and then they have to go through the process of cleaning that up and taking care of that contamination and stuff.
Gotcha.
So we don't know, who knows how long this is going to go on. So we're going to probably just look at next November as the date that we'll do the Oktoberfest, and we'll try to make up for it in different things. We have a golf tournament coming up, and that should go on without any issues.
Okay.
So there's just
the beat goes on. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and it's fall. The weather's getting cooler, so we've got so many people contacting us.
I'm sure.
Wanting to do events and bringing dogs out for adoption.
All right, well, we got to run now, Rick, but good luck with Canines and Cowgirls Adoptable Pet Fashion Show this Sunday, October 27th, 4 to 8, at the neighborhood Bark Bar. So thanks for joining us again on Talk Animals. Good luck with everything else.
Appreciate you very much, Duncan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Stay tuned for the conversation with Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter and Jim Bannon after that with music and Nancy C following that. Talking Animals.